Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem van Horst. All right, another week has gone by. Things have been interesting. I'm finally caught up with all the episodes I had recorded before having a big boost of a lot of different kinds of activities and work going on. So apologies to Jason. Jason's my guest for this particular episode. We had a fantastic conversation. I'm pretty excited to share this out with you. I met Jason Pitre. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce your name, Jason. I apologize. I would pronounce it Pitre en français, Pitre or Peter in English. I'm not exactly sure. But in any case, Peter is a game designer and, as he said it himself, bureaucrat by day, game designer by night, and game publisher as well. Very active in the role-playing game community and indie role-playing games in particular, and also a coffee roaster, which we talk about and geek out about coffee a little bit at the beginning of the episode. And really have a great conversation about what are different kinds of role-playing games, what's Jason up to in terms of game design, what he believes in, what are examples from some of his games. And we talk about conventions, we talk about how to find out about role-playing games, because really I'm more interested these days in getting interested in how to get other people to discover role-playing games and what value they have. And this is one of the reasons I'm very interested in the new kind of experimental games coming out of indie game design and small publishers. And we compare the whole role-playing game and tabletop hobby games to the alcohol and craft beer world, which was a fun analogy ongoing in the conversation as well. So I'll let you listen to that one. But one of the things that, and I mentioned in my last episode, I'm thinking of organizing an experimental sort of pivot to the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast to have people in creative industries and marketing like me, strategists ideally to begin with, but perhaps just anybody in this industry, and to play role-playing games together, and particularly to play the indie kind of role-playing games that are not Dungeons & Dragons, that I still find myself, of course, because it's the most famous one, and we talk about that a little bit as well, when people are like, oh, what are you into? I'm like, I really like role-playing games. Oh, like Dungeons & Dragons. I'm like, well, yeah, sort of, but yes and no, because I don't really play Dungeons and Dragons, and it's not the most interesting. And it's not that it's not interesting, but it's not the game I play the most. In any case, my point being, if you would like to reach out to me, if you're interested in being on the podcast and playing a game with me, then please reach out to me in my email. You can reach out either via email. It's Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Or on Twitter, IC Willem, letters I-C-W-I-L-L-E-M, or type in my name, Willem van Horst, you'll find me. And or on Facebook, you'll also find me on Facebook. And or you can like all the ways to find me on the main website at www.icecreamforeveryone, everything spelled out like ice cream that you eat in the summer.net. So that's all there. Please reach out if you want to be on the podcast, if you'd like to play a game with me. I'd like to organize that sooner rather than later. I'm going to be going on vacation celebrating my 40th birthday this summer, and I'm going to update my scheduling of the episodes. I'm not exactly sure how many I'm going to be publishing and producing over the course of the summer. Might slow down a bit, just so you know. But then again, if you listen to the podcast, you're not that surprised that I have just breaks and unexpected pauses that are, you know, very opposite to the regular rules of publishing podcasts. But anyhow, that's not really the point. See here, near, or near, or I can't say it. Here nor there. Okay. I managed to pull that one out. It's not even that interesting. So, that's about it right now. Just don't forget, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave it a rating or a review. 5-star, please. And or share it with a friend. Post it on social media. Reach out to me because it really helps me keep motivated to publish new episodes if you enjoy it. And I always really, really enjoy reading from you. If you post a review on iTunes and go through the trouble, I'll read it here as well. I don't think there's been any new ones recently. And that's about it. Without any further ado, here's Jason. Or further ado, here's Jason. Further ado. Okay. Jason Pitre, everyone. Thank you. Jason, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you so much. It is. I'm very excited. I two things. I caught myself saying that And I've been listening. I've been catching up on a bunch of editing of my own shows. And I keep saying I'm excited. I don't know if it's believable every time, but I am genuinely excited to talk to every guest I talk to.
I understand that feeling, having my own podcast.
Right? And I'm particularly in this case, because the last few conversations I had were more with professionals in the advertising and marketing industry that I do talk to as well, but I've talked to less game designers, and now it's been a little while since I talked to a game designer. So that's particularly in this case why I'm excited. And we briefly met last year at the end of Gen Con, which you'd obviously had like a lot of different conversations for the course of 4 days, I'm sure, right?
Somewhat back to back.
I can only imagine. I mean, I it was my first Gen Con. I hadn't been to Gen Con before, and it was really as a dilettante that I was going. So I did play games and GM a couple of games on the role playing games. That just like, you know, I did a good spread of experiencing all the different facets of it. I think maybe not everything, but you know, it was cool. So I made some notes, and this is where I thought we could start because I thought it was interesting. So you have a publishing business, I guess, Genesis of Legend. Yep. And there's somewhere on the website that I spotted that you say you have a bunch of different hats because it's, you know, not a very big business. And one of them is a barista for the business.
Yeah. It's mostly that for myself, I've been roasting my own coffee beans, which is a delightful hobby.
How did you get into roasting coffee beans and like, you know, geeking out? I'm assuming that's like a level of geekiness about coffee when you start roasting your
own. Oh, there is. Yeah. So it's mostly that. So by night, I'm designing games and publishing them. Yeah. By day, I'm a bureaucrat policy wonk. So
what, I didn't catch that. Policy wonk? I'm sorry. I don't know what that means.
Oh, so policy wonk is a term of jargon.
Oh, policy wonk. Two words. Okay, I thought
wonk. Yes, sorry. Policy wonk.
Okay, I'm following now. All right.
Yep. So you effectively can't survive in my industry without copious amounts of coffee. And naturally enough, that led to me finding the best cups of coffee that I could get in my area. And then discovering, oh, I could roast my own.
So do you buy the beans? Because I've never done this before, but you buy the beans and does it take a huge amount of involvement to be roasting them or
Nope. Or
equipment? It doesn't. Or not really?
No. So there's little home roasters, and you can get them the cheapest, easiest ones you can get for, what, $75? Cool. And what you do is you buy green coffee beans, so pre-roasted. This is after they've been in the berry form, but before they've turned black or brown. So because they're green, all the oils are sort of still made up into the bean. And when you roast it, that's when the oils come out.
Okay.
Which means that green coffee beans will last 2 to 3 years without going bad.
Oh, wow.
So I wind up buying green coffee beans in bulk. You know, here's 20 pounds of green coffee beans. And then I just roast once a week and maybe twice a week. And then I have freshly roasted coffee. You know, a couple days after it's roasted, it's good to go. You just grind it up fresh. And you get a remarkably good and nuanced cup of coffee.
What's your preferred or go-to level of roasting? Or style? I don't know what the right term is.
So, my personal preference is somewhere in a full city roast. But my better half always likes the lightest roasts that you can find. So it's a point of contention locally. Okay. So usually I just compromise on her end and I just get decent coffee beans that work well.
Cool.
Coffee
making, preferred coffee making method?
So because I'm lazy, my default is using an AeroPress.
Okay.
Which is very easy. It's about $40 to get this little plastic contraption, and it pretty much makes espresso.
Yeah, I've used it. One of my best friends is a big fan of the AeroPress, and I've used it at his place, but I'm even lazier and I use a French press. Well, it's arguable whether it's lazier or not. I don't know, but
cleanup is easier with an AeroPress.
Right.
Because you can just pop the little puck of coffee out and then you're done.
Yes. There's a certain amount of volume that I like from the French press, but
That's fair. I also use Chemex. It takes a bit longer. It's a pour over. And there's other more obscure forms. There used to be this very specific kind of coffee making equipment that was bought out by Starbucks, and therefore you can no longer get it, called Clover, which made some phenomenal coffee.
Cool.
But
all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. So that is the coffee 101.
Coffee story. Perfect. All right. So usually, otherwise, I like to go back a little bit. So you're, you're based in Ottawa now. I don't know if that's where you grew up or.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm strange because not knowing exactly the detailed demographics of all your listeners, but I'm Acadian. So I was born in the Maritimes of Canada. My family came from there, but I was actually born on the other side in Victoria.
Okay.
And then I moved to Ottawa. So you usually don't get many Acadians in Victoria.
In Victoria, right, yeah. But did you grow up in a bilingual household, French, English, or not so much?
Somewhat. It's the old chestnut of three quarters of my grandparents were Francophones, so we only spoke English at home.
Right, yeah.
So because one bilingual and one Anglophone means they spoke English. Then one Anglophone and one bilingual means they spoke English.
Right.
So.
And I was asking also because I was born in the States but grew up in France. And my friend Julien Poire, who has another podcast in French that I tend to contribute from time to time, he was the person who said, oh, you should go say hi to Jason at Gen Con.
Right.
So that was was that link on the French side of things.
Right.
And so how did you get into, how was your childhood and how did you get into tabletop gaming?
Pretty straightforward childhood, you know, standard suburb kid. But I got invited over to play, you know, I started with Magic, the Gathering back in the day. And it didn't take long before a local GM who was recruiting kids dragged us over and ran my first role-playing game, which was RuneQuest.
Oh, cool.
Note, I am not old enough for RuneQuest to be my first game, but he was a classical DM. So he ran RuneQuest and Rifts and First Ed D&D and Bushido and all sorts of games. Gave me a decent variety at the start, and I wound up playing for quite a while under him, right until university.
Cool. And did you start GMing at any of that point or later or?
Yeah. So, high school, I started, desperately planning and over preparing for my first, D&D second edition game. And that was actually the seed behind all of my, game design and game publishing work. Because anyone who remembers Second Ed D&D knows that there was a lot of material near the end, and it was not terribly consistent, which means that the high school kid decided, oh, let's just go through, you know, frantically collect all of the material we possibly can and then combine all of it and go through all of it and turn it into a set of four binders that say, this is all the D&D. I have only selected the things I like that are good enough. Now let's do some world building. Now let's do all of
Yeah.
this.
Can you unpack that a little bit? Because it was interesting. You were asking about my listenership earlier, and I'd love to have a little bit more. It's not like it's gigantic or anything, but I've had, as I said, I mentioned earlier, I work in marketing and advertising. So I have people from that world listen. And then I talk to game designers and have people from tabletop game design. And I've had good echoes of people who work in marketing and advertising who enjoy finding out and learning about storytelling and role-playing games. Not so much the other way around, but so I don't know if that exists the other way around. All that to say, it'd be awesome if you told us a little bit about what you thought about the Dungeons and Dragons system at the time, and what were some of the qualities that you're talking about that you wanted to either amend or change, or that weren't that great. If you can find a 101 way to talk about it, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. So,
Layman's is what I was thinking.
yep. So functionally, the way that D&D worked was their entire business model was, hey, let's just pump out supplements. And they actually call it the supplement treadmill, where they would continuously put out new books and as cheap as they could make them, as quickly as they could make them, to try to keep the creditors at bay. Fast forward 5 years and they go bankrupt. That was the story of TSR. So what this meant is they produced a lot of material. They had some very very smart people with no central direction, and it was still rather early in the craft. So it was 20 years into the art form. So we're talking about movies in the 30s in Hollywood, where they're still trying to figure out exactly how all these things work. So it was very inconsistent, and there were some real gems, and there was a lot of rough, let's slap it together. So you would get one book that is a detailed discussion about thieves in the criminal underworld, and everything's explaining Victorian slang and what a burglar is versus a con man versus
Right.
a
A
sneak
pickpocket
thief.
or
Yeah. And then you'll get the complete book of elves. And this is the kind of elf that rides griffins. And this is the kind of elf that slowly turns into a tree. And so there was no consistency. They were all very different between each other. So there had to be a lot of curation going on in order to actually make it usable. So that was a lot of what I was doing, trying to sort of edit and compile and bring things together so that it would be a consistent message and a consistent tone across wildly different material.
Yeah. And so, and at the same time, you're preparing games, and that was at the same time you're studying in college. All right, cool. Great. And you started writing your own games by the same token of gathering everything? Was it seem like a natural step or?
Yeah, so generally I started there and then I moved on to working on a fan project for one of the White Wolf games, Demon of the Fallen, for those in the audience who, from the game designing perspective. And it was a terrible project, but it was a good excuse for me to really get the biggest mistakes out of my system and take a test run.
What do you think some
And
of those
then,
mistakes were?
I hadn't done nearly enough research. For instance, so I at that point, I had functionally known Dungeons and Dragons, and White Wolf. And that was the sum total of role-playing games. Like, I had played some other ones, but for the most part, those were the models I was using.
Yeah, so talking about the rules in particular, or?
The rules, the structure of texts. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you need to have 40 pages of fiction up front.
Yes.
Because that's how role-playing games work, right? So there was a lot of unconsidered expectations, and I was trying to effectively follow the rote formula that I was discovering without expanding my horizons enough. So it taught me a lot of things. It was a very good process, but it was the first project, and I don't think it's even possible to find it online anymore, which is a bit of a relief.
Yeah.
And then I started actually designing my own real standalone indie game, which was the Spark role-playing game.
Yes, I have it right now.
Which I published in 2013, I believe.
Cool. So you used a term that I wanted to dig into a little bit, but I wasn't sure. I was just letting me think about which word I want to go in. Okay, so indie game design. So at these days, Dungeons & Dragons is like, you know, the most known, and we talked about it a little bit, and we talked about previous editions. And I just read an article over the weekend that I put in my newsletter from the Washington Post about why it's bigger than ever. Wizards of the Coast, who publishes it, sold more copies last year than ever before, apparently. And in my experience here in Chicago in the past couple of years, so it's like, it's just very skewed. I've explored some stuff, but I don't really know for sure. Dungeons and Dragons, aside from the beginning of playing role-playing games, then didn't tend to be my favorite kind of game. But it seems like it's extremely popular, obviously, and more people are getting to know about role-playing games thanks to Dungeons and Dragons. How much do you think it's good as a gateway to get people to know other kinds of play, either in literally other kinds of games or different styles of play?
So it's our flagship.
Yeah.
Within the industry, this is using alcohol as a reference point. This is Bud Light.
Yeah.
Like, everyone knows what it is. It is acceptable to the largest variety of people, and it is a introduction that the smaller fish, well, the medium fish can then take advantage of. And then the smaller independent craft breweries then get a slot at their, at sort of the cultivated audience of specialists.
Okay.
So they are largely the feeder group for all of the rest of us, because they actually have something resembling a marketing budget.
Yes.
We do not. This is literally my marketing budget.
Yes, exactly.
So
how do you define indie? So would you keep using the same alcohol analogy for what is an indie role-playing game?
Yep. So effectively, one of the big macro breweries is D&D. One of the middle of the line, larger independent ones would be like Unibrew used to be in the good old days, would be one of the medium scale publishers. And the rest of us are all small artists who are effectively running our own brew pubs with four tanks,
yeah,
and we're slowly pumping out interesting experimental brews.
Yeah, yeah. Herbaceous sour beer of the world,
yeah,
or something.
We're the kind of people who will brew a sour stout.
Okay, yes, that's one.
None of the big guys will do that.
Yeah.
For good reason. So we're the experimental branch. And then sometimes the best of us will get brought up the food chain. For instance, the fantastic Chris Spivey, who published independently published Harlem Unbound, which is a game that is exploring the Cthulhu mythos content, Call of Cthulhu, etc., within the context of Harlem, and specifically Black Harlem in the 1920s, and race politics and redlining, and the general takeaway is that we're not sure what's worse, racism or the Eldritch horrors that are going to eat our souls. They're probably both equally bad. So Chris did some amazing work on that.
Check that out. I haven't read it or played it.
And he got hired by Chaosium, which is one of the great old ones of the industry. Middle tier, just below D&D. But they are one of those mid-sized publishers who've been around for a long time and actually have staff.
Yeah.
The little indie crew folks like me, no. We're mostly doing it on sweat equity. But it's very nice to see folks being brought up the proverbial food chain.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And so back to your side, if we think about, I mean, this is a great analogy, I'm guessing. So now taking it back towards game design and what you started getting interested in, what would you say your, I don't know, I saw one of your blog posts you just published now, you talk about your design praxis. I don't know if that's where it started or what you were looking at or what you got interested in exploring with your game design.
So, yeah, it's everyone's designing for their own reasons and with their own raison d'être, functionally. Yeah. And for myself, both as an artist and as a small business owner who's trying to get people to pay attention.
Yes.
The most important thing I can do is to produce meaningful and memorable experiences. Because if I do that, then those gaming stories will spread through word of mouth, and other people will want to check out the things that I am making. So I'm trying to make memorable, emotionally moving games that make people think about serious issues, so that we can use games to teach people how to be better humans through the incredible empathy building that is available in the role-playing game hobby.
That's great. And I really love that. And I saw some of that in that latest blog post. And I agree. It's one of the things I really, really always enjoyed about role-playing games. I think building empathy, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. There's tons of different various potential that is only, we're only scratching the surface, or we've only scratched the surface so far. And there's only very few people that are like you and that are getting interested in this area. So I don't. So we just touched on Spark, and this is one I read, and I really like this system about. And I don't know if it's most representative about what you just talked about, but if there's something else, please feel free to tell me. There's a system in Spark, which is a generic system, so you can create different types of universes to go along with it. And there's this idea of exploring people's beliefs as it goes.
Yep.
That I really,
yeah,
I don't know if you want to talk
through
about.
Line.
Yeah.
So I effectively always come up with certain premises and certain areas of thought that that I'm trying to explore in each of my games.
Yeah.
In Spark, it's actually based on a very simple hypothetical. What if people would actually change what they believed after being presented evidence?
Yes,
which that is not how humans work.
No, but it's a great way, which is part of the reason why I thought it was like, it is really interesting conceit. It's like, well, it's great. What if that was the case? Yeah.
Yeah.
Not in a pragmatic fashion, because you're actually exploring very emotional areas in the whole game. I mean, you can.
Yeah. It's meant to effectively ask the players to bring forward those meaty questions that they're trying to explore in their own lives, and then put them on the table, and then explore them in sort of a remixing of multiple of them in a fictional context. So, for instance, if I want to explore the idea of nationalism, and I'm coming from the perspective that nationalism is a poison, that means that I'm going to be making sure that the fictional context is sort of exploring and poking at that idea, so I can find out if I really believe in that, or if I can learn more functionally.
Yeah.
And then you would present your own issue, subjective controversial declaration. Like, what would you come up with?
My own controversial declaration about...
Yep. About life, the universe, and everything. This is the kind of thing, like, greed is good.
Okay, so yeah, religion is the root of all evil.
Yep.
That would be
so one. We would then go through and play things about nationalism is a poison and religion is the root of all evil, and then talk about a secular government that's trying to protect people from a oppressive religious group.
Great. And then we have the whole area to explore. Yep.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of interesting content there, and moral ambiguity, and a lot of drama that comes out of that. And in the process, we get to more deeply explore a lot of interesting issues. And that was the heart behind Spark.
Fantastic.
And I've designed a number of other games that are exploring different issues.
Yep.
My game Sig, Manual of the Primes, is both a pastiche from an old D&D setting and Planescape. But it's also an exploration on family, faith, and politics. It's about how cities evolve and how the process of waves of immigration will change the nature of spaces, and people get older communities get displaced by newer communities, who are in turn displaced by newer communities, and how cities themselves change their composition, and how people have to try to adapt to fit this changing context.
And so, sorry, I might be just playing back what you're saying, but are players in this game then... So they're exploring how that evolves and what kind of difficulties they're faced with in the changing city.
Yep.
Yeah. And what kind of stuff, or is there any particular mechanism or rule that you put in place to better simulate that? Or is it only in a description of the setting, or?
So functionally, this is a magical city in the middle of a multiverse that is connected to the eternal plane of fire and the plane of justice and the plane of shadows. Those influences of flame, justice, and shadows will actually be represented in the city. So the buildings are actually made of solidified flame.
Right.
With window panes of shimmering heat. There's lightning clad angels that are jumping from rooftop to rooftop, watching to stop crime or violence. And there's things walking in the shadows, and there's an entire secret society and an undergovernment that's moving around under the watchful eyes of the angels. Now, whenever players change their beliefs, some of those tethers will change. And the plane of flames might turn into the plane of stone.
Okay.
Now, suddenly, all the buildings get put out, and giant spires of rock come shooting out of the ground. Giants start pouring in, and you wind up getting this community that used to be full of salamanders and ifrit is now, they're all being displaced because there's a horde of giant refugees and dwarves moving in.
Oh, this is great. Thank you. Oh, that's cool. I know that I had spotted Sega, but I missed out playing. I tried to play it when I was at Gen Con last year, and then the tables were full at the last minute going or so. But that's something that I still have to read and try it at some point. Changing gears just slightly, it was interesting. I heard you on another podcast that was just like glanced upon, like figuratively listened at. You mentioned that you really don't really like being in the limelight or at the center of attention. I don't know if that's regular.
Well,
the question was, in particular, and you can comment on that particular part, but I was wondering, and we're talking about, you know, this is your marketing budget, right? And you share a lot of different things with the community. And I find that really interesting too, in your design process and publishing. And where do you think where does the energy and the drive come from? Because you're doing that at night too, right? And yep. Or to go to conventions, which is like not, you know, it's quite demanding, I can say. I mean, it's fun, but it can be demanding when it's your level. You're both trying to talk to a lot of different people and talk about your games, et cetera, be on various podcasts like this one.
Yeah. It's a combination of being a workaholic and being passionate about getting other people to get their stories out.
Yeah.
I'm afforded a lot of opportunity and a lot of access that most people don't get access to. So I view it as my responsibility to, when I make a platform, to try to share it with people who don't have as much of a platform. I'm trying to produce resources and trying to give people the tools so that they're able to make their own art, even though they don't have as much ability to go to conventions. That's actually one of the reasons why I run my podcast, which is the RPG Design Panelcast.
Yeah, I was going to ask
it's
you about
that.
All
too. Podcast recordings from conventions, because it turns out that folks from Australia and folks from Russia and China have a hard time making it to the States.
Yes.
To go to game conventions. So I'm recording panels and seminars and getting them out in the world.
Yeah. Now, which is great. It's fantastic. I know that when I discovered it, and I didn't really know much about it before, I got in touch and, I'm behind on everything I want to consume in terms of media anyway, regardless.
I know that feeling.
And let alone media I'm trying to produce, or I mean, you know, some I successfully produce, but nowhere near as much as I'd like. But, you know, that's just the way it goes. I was wondering, this is another question. So talking about the kind of games that we do in terms of indie and moving from the Bud Light and Dungeons and Dragons to the maybe sour stouts of, or some are sour stouts of indie role-playing games. The other thing is typically a lot of people play in a regular group and they play with the same group because they're the friends that they've been friends with for a while. And what's your experience? And I don't know if you've had that experience or anybody you know or heard of. If there's one person in the group that starts getting a taste for the sour stout, but everybody else wants to keep drinking Bud, as it were.
So then they will typically try to convince their friends, discover their friends won't, and then seek out the other strange folks who like sour stouts. Conventions are actually great places for that, and I'm helping to organize a local convention in Ottawa which has been around since 1977. So, and we've consistently been running a track of weird indie games. So, for instance, I'm going to be running Companion's Tale by Sweet Potato Press, The Spire by Rowan Rookin.
Oh, yeah, I just started reading The Spire.
Yeah, it's so evocative. It's beautiful.
It is. It's gorgeous. I want to run it for sure.
Good Society, which is a Pride and Prejudice simulator, functionally, by Story Brewers, and a bunch of my own games. So, because I'm going in and running the weird games, it sort of helped foster a community of people who normally don't get a chance. They get to actually come to this convention and enjoy all of the sour stout that they can manage to drink over a weekend. And that helps build community more broadly.
Yeah, absolutely. This is great. Thanks. I definitely want to meet more people. I mean, this is something I've gone on to the Julien of the French podcast on, and I mean, yes, I hate to say I complained, but I did in a very French fashion, complained about the fact that I didn't really so far find too many people in Chicago that want to play those kinds of games. But I know they're around. I know there are groups.
There are a lot of them around.
I know there's tons of people that play those games. I just haven't met them or put the right kind of effort into it, or wasn't lucky, or just got busy with other things. I have no idea exactly, but yeah.
Well, anyway. Specifically in your case, there were a whole bunch of events being coordinated by the Jankcast podcast over at Chicagoland Games, the Dice Dojo.
Oh, really? I missed that completely then, because I go to Dice Dojo quite regularly. I definitely go for the tabletop board game night, and I've been a couple of times for Dungeons & Dragons Adventures League, and that was like, I don't think Adventures League is much for me, and I'm not sure how long I want to hang out there to try to meet people to play other games, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there are other people.
Yeah, I'm sure there
guaranteed.
Are. Just, all right, I'll have to give that another go and check the schedule, and maybe I can meet the right kind of people. Cool. I have another question. So this is something I was just looking at this afternoon, and I was wondering what I can talk about. So, talking about my job in marketing and advertising, and I run brand strategy, and I'm increasingly studying games and looking at what can I steal from role-playing games and tabletop games to run as workshop exercises to be either games or game-like experiments. And I'm working on a project at the moment. I spent the afternoon running interviews to find out more about this particular business that I'm just trying to think how much I could say about it. It's in the financial industry. And basically, they do something that's really complicated that I barely understand. They need to find a new way to talk about it so that it makes more sense to people. So that's where I come in terms of helping them communicate. And I'm studying and looking at what kind of games I could. So, for example, I'm rereading, and I think I can pull some stuff from Microscope. I think that's something, and I don't know. Right. Would you like to talk about Microscope a little bit, just so anybody?
Yeah, yeah. So Microscope. A Microscope is an excellent game in the weird end of the spectrum. It is definitely an indie game. And effectively, the way that you do it is you collaboratively make a timeline out of index cards. So you, at the table, cooperatively say, oh, this is going to be going from the rise of civilization to the collapse of the First Empire. And then you put it in another card that's in the middle of these two and says, the rise of the three city-states. Mm. And you say, oh, this is a bad thing. Okay. So it has a tone. And then you discover as you go why that was bad and sort of create a story that way.
Yeah. And you explore the kind of nature of that. So I guess question here is, given I'm looking at Microscope, and is there anything else that you'd recommend me looking at that are either like it or exploratory in the same, the same vibe. You're exploring situations or people, I was going to say modular, because Microscope, you can create many different types of scenarios.
Right. So you can always look at they have a couple other games. Kingdom and Follow are also by Lame Mage Productions. They run off some similar principles with different tools. So those are always good to look at. And if you're looking for a variety of interesting design tools, I will always recommend the book Seven Wonders by Pelgrane Press. It's an anthology of seven small games. They cover a wide gamut of really interesting subject matter. It varies from we're going on a final space expedition to we're all of the people who were left behind at home when the adventurers ran off to go slay a dragon, to we're all the kids from Narnia in therapy as adults.
It reminded me that one was on my reading list, because I was at Dragon Meet, a convention in London, when the book was it was coming out, and so a few of the authors came, and I attended a talk about it, and I was like, oh, I need to read that, and then it became lost in the list of things to read anyway.
Yeah, I strongly recommend it because it's delightful. Fantastic. And it's exactly the kind of thing we need to see more of.
Great. This is a great reminder. Thank you very much for that. All right. So let's see. We talked about a bunch of stuff, and just like circling back, when you started designing games, was there any shift when you started designing games to say, all right, you know what? Not only do I want to design those games, maybe it is natural. I was going to say to publishing and to sharing everything else with the industry. I guess, but then again, if you're designing a game, I guess it's natural to want to see it out there. But I guess, what was your experience of it?
So, I previously said that I was driven by passion, but a lot of it is also tied into my interest in learning. That is my prime motivator. And it's actually tied into a book of game design theory that's actually very relevant to a marketing audience as well.
Okay.
Which is the theory of fun by, I believe it's Greg Kostler.
Yeah.
Functionally says that the experience of enjoyment of a thing is related to how much you're learning. And if it is too hard, you'll get frustrated and you won't have fun, because you won't be learning. If it's too easy, it won't be testing you, so you'll get bored, so you won't have fun. You have to have exactly the right difficulty curve in order for it to be teaching you and therefore an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, it is a fantastic book. I actually recommend it to somebody else who works in my industry, like just yesterday, I think, Ralph Koster.
Yeah, so that is the reason why I started publishing, functionally, because it teaches you a large variety of skills. I actually now do professional level graphic design and layout.
Right.
Because I'm publishing role-playing games.
Yes.
And it's a very cost-effective way to do business in my particular industry.
Yes.
Let's just say that the financial compensation in role-playing games is meager.
Yes, mostly the glory. And my agreeing on the other side was my deciding to get into podcasting got me into audio editing, even though I'm not really particularly amazing at it, but I'm discovering all sorts of stuff all the time.
Yeah, I mean, simply knowing how to use a compressor is delightful. I've been podcasting too and doing audio editing, and I'm writing and editing and doing contract work, as in developing contracts. So publishing has taught me a great deal. So that's sort of been the motivator to dive into it.
Fantastic. And we also mentioned conventions. I don't know if there's any, like, I imagine you go to a lot of them, but are there ones that you recommend, let's say, for people who are starting out and want to discover it or want to try? Are gaming events and organized play like Adventures League or similar or conventions the best place to start if you want to try out role-playing games?
So, I would say that if you want to try out role-playing games, conventions are usually good places because the folks who run convention games tend to be above average in terms of experience levels. And they're intentionally designing an experience that is good to go regardless of the experience levels of the participants. So that's always getting into the hobby, that's a great way to go. Now, if anyone wants to go deeper into the design publishing end of things, I would strongly recommend that people attend Metatopia in Morristown, New Jersey, every November. It is a board and role-playing game design convention. Most conventions make things free for the people running games, or really cheap for people running games, and charge the attendees. Metatopia flips the model and makes it expensive for people running games, and cheap for people to attend and just play. Because game designers and professionals in the industry are the audience. And functionally, people coming to play games are the product.
Wow. I was on my radar already to go because I want to learn more. But putting it this way, given I'm nowhere near being a professional yet, I could be the product in this case.
There's also a lot. Usually three panel tracks at any point in time. And if anyone is coming from the marketing background and wants to check things out, this is really good cross-pollination because they're always looking for more experts to talk about things. Because turns out a lot of folks in my industry don't know what marketing is and think that marketing and advertising is their, you know, synonyms. And don't even know what brand marketing is. So we're all very enthusiastic and not knowing the playing field. So jump if any experienced marketers want to check out our industry, we would love to have you.
That is great. It's a very, very good call. And it's interesting. This goes for everything, but I had the thought earlier, you know, I was mentioning these clients I'm working with, they're very, very smart people. But particularly working in an area that I know very little about, which is one of the things I enjoy about my job, to dive into a completely different industry and help them figure out how to communicate. And it's those times where I realize that actually that is my skill, because sometimes I can easily think, well, no, I don't really know anything. I talk BS most of the time. That's really all I know how to do. But then I come across these people, and I'm like, oh my God, you really don't know how to communicate what it is you do in a way that's clear for the rest of the world. And actually, that's a skill that I do have. So anyway, not to underplay it or anything. It's just like,
you know, communication skills are incredibly important, and far too few people actually have them. I don't count myself as having good communication skills.
That said, I do also think that playing role-playing games is something that does help in creating in communication skills. And or at least I like to say that it's helped me better speak in front of an audience and organize the way I wanted to think and tell a story if I'm going to be presenting something. In the same way that I sometimes think about, all right, what's the flow of that particular story? And if I'm going to present an event to the players, what's the first thing I want to present to them so that they get interested in checking out the next thing that I have in mind to go for them to go check out, for example. even though I like to play in a kind of sandbox way so they're quite free, but I think about, you know, what are the possible things that might happen, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right, cool. This is great. So we're going to move on and start wrapping up, but I usually finish with these cool down questions because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. And because of that, that's quite simple. I have an ice cream flavor. Do you have a favorite flavor?
It's really hard to choose because I've had enough Jenny's ice cream.
Oh, I love Jenny's ice cream. I'm assuming that you're aware. Fantastic.
Yes.
So good.
But there's so many interesting varieties that it's it's challenging.
What are the ones you remember right now anyway?
Oh, there was a delightful, I think it was a bramble berry and honey.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
So for anybody, we actually
We actually had a local place that actually did an Elvis ice cream that was banana and peanut butter and chocolate.
Oh, that's a pretty good combo. I haven't had one of those.
Yeah,
Jenny's is a kind of Midwestern local. They're out of Columbus, Ohio first, and they have several parlors here in Chicago and a few others elsewhere, and I guess Ottawa then, right?
No.
Oh, no. Okay, you just knew
so
about
one
it.
So one of the big conventions, the second largest convention for tabletop games is in Columbus, Ohio.
Of course it is, yes. I've been thinking about trying to go to Origins. I need to look at it, actually. Completely forgot. It's next month, right?
And no, there's a June. There's a Jenny's ice cream within walking distance of the convention center.
Oh, it must be taken by assault during the conventions.
Yeah, it really is.
That was badly translated from French in my head. It didn't make sense. But yeah, it's taken over.
Oh, no. It makes perfect sense. But mostly because I think in bilingual.
There's one time I remember going here and they had like the very last remains of a special they'd made that was out of this world. And it was, corn syrup custard and burnt bourbon something. And it
was, wow.
It was amazing. I was like, I have no idea. This is just completely crazy. When they said corn syrup custard, I was like, I don't even know what that means, but please give me some. It sounds amazing.
Oh. Before we close, can I toss you a bilingual pun?
Sure. And I was going to ask you a couple more questions before we close anyway, but yeah.
So what does the owl say?
Ooh, ooh.
Key.
What? Key?
Key.
Oh, ooh, ooh. No, what?
Who?
Oh, who? Okay, I was missing the beginning of the presentation. I was like, where?
Yes.
Where?
So what does the owl say is key?
I wasn't thinking of the H. I was thinking, ooh, ooh. And I was like, wait a minute. That means where? Yep. Sorry, that was bad to me. Okay, so any game that you recently played that you really enjoy and recommend everybody playing?
I will have to say Red Carnations on a Black Grave.
Okay.
By Catherine Rahman, which is a boutique indie game that is coming to Kickstarter soon. And it's all about the doomed and failed French communes of Paris.
Ooh, I want that. I want to play that.
It's a tragedy. There's a handful of games that are effectively tragedy engines, and this is one of them.
Okay.
It's delightful and very, you know, gripping. Although I'm also going to selfishly steal another spot and say One Child's Heart by Camden Wright, which is also currently on Kickstarter, is delightful, and it's one of the leading games in the industry in that it is all about teaching people how to help vulnerable kids adapt to hard situations and learn to live and despite the personal challenges they face. It's really deeply moving. And I can't say nice enough things about it.
Cool. I'll check that out too. What's the last or recent piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
So I've been going through, there's a series of books from Nathan Lowell, which were began with the book Quarter Share, which you can download for free, where he narrates it. It's delightful. And whenever a new book comes out, I've just been diving right into it. And he's got some around a dozen books, and they're all fantastic. A lot of them are coming of age, stories about people and their relationships and learning what their place is in the world. And it's just nice, and I've effectively grown up with some of these characters. So I recently devoured one of the more recent books, and it's left an impression.
Great. I'll check it out. Awesome. And the last one, if you could give someone one thing or something to everyone, like you make a wish and that whatever that thing, it doesn't have to be a thing. It could be anything. Everybody has it. What might that be?
I think that would have to be an understanding of the unspoken assumptions that we're all wrapped up in. Effectively seeing how society is favoring certain communities because they tend to be predominantly white over certain communities that are predominantly people of color, how men are treated differently from women, how all these sort of different unspoken assumptions in society exist, and just being able to see them, because it's so easy to just ignore some of the structural things that we're all struggling with.
That's great. Thank you. Like also a great place to end. I think it's a opening on that side of things. Cool. All right. Well, let's just make sure people know where can people find you online, look you up, where you tend to be the most active.
Yeah. So you can find me at genesisoflegend.com. I'm on Twitter at genesisoflegend. You can also find my podcast, the RPG Design Panelcast. If you just search for panel cast one word, you'll find it. And yeah, feel free to get in touch with me at any point in time, where I'm happy to talk everything from roasting coffee to systematic oppression.
Yes. And so we talked quickly about Origins. Is that the next big convention you're going to be at, or
I'm going to be skipping that particular event this time, because well, crossing international borders is a bit more challenging. I'm hoping to make it to Queen City Conquest in Buffalo. Okay. This summer.
All right. Well, we'll see about that one. But that's great. Thank you so much for your time, Jason. I really appreciate it. And yeah, have a great end of day.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's another episode wrapped up. As I said before, and presumably if you're still listening now, you've enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed the conversation with Jason. Looking forward to playing some of his games. I definitely have them on my radar for the experimental recording of pivoting or expanding the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast to be the podcast where creative marketing professionals play tabletop role-playing games. I wouldn't do necessarily live-action play. It would be recording them and editing. Which is going to be an interesting editing exercise for me, but I'm interested in trying it out and seeing how that works. As I said earlier, it makes a difference if you post a review. If you just open up your Apple, iPhone, or Android favorite podcast application and or go directly to iTunes, I think things are going to change and they're planning some updates to the podcasting application, at least I hope so, to make it easier for people to leave a 5-star or review. It helps me keep motivated for the website. It helps others find the website or just reach up with a word of feedback or a question, either by email, that's villum at icecreamforeveryone.net or on Twitter at icywillem, letters I, letters C, W-I-L-L-E-M. I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening again, for tuning in. I'll see you or speak to you soon enough, I'm sure. Good afternoon, morning, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. Thanks. Bye.